If you're in the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale marketplace where each piece is carefully vetted and verified by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. If you're in the market, use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
We want to help shift the social change conversation from critics to builders. We want to shift the metaphor of diversity work in America from melting pot and battleground to potluck. We want to help facilitate in the next great chapter of American religion. We think we're done with the chapter Judeo-Christian. It did good work in its time. It's time to move into interfaith America. And we want to convince people that you defeat the things you do not love by building the things you do, and that that is a profound opportunity to be able to build something better. It is holy, it is sacred, and we should take that opportunity and be grateful for it.
It is my pleasure and privilege to welcome to Forward, the founder and president of Interfaith America, member of President Obama's inaugural Faith Council, and the author of the phenomenal new book, We Need to Build, amen to that, Field Notes for Diverse Democracy, Mr. Eboo Patel. Welcome, Eboo.
Andrew, I can't tell you how excited I am to be on this podcast. Thank you.
Are you kidding, man? I'm excited to have you. I mean, you've been building an awesome organization for years and years, helping to cultivate religious diversity in America, or not cultivate it, maybe cultivate acceptance of it, since the religious diversity has happened without you. But I loved your book in part because you did something that I try to do when I write, which is tell the truth, including sometimes that when like the truth is rough. How did you, let's give people a brief summary of how you came to this work and what Interfaith America does.
Sure. So I was an activist in college. That was the mid-1990s. It was another moment of kind of racial reckoning, of identity-based politics, of social justice work, and I got involved in kind of the warp and woof of that, and it was an exciting moment. But the problem is that my initiation into activism was of the anger-based variety, and I am not by nature an angry person, and I don't think that tearing down the system is the best way to approach social change. But that was kind of the sector of activism that I first got caught in, and it was faith-based approaches that kind of helped bring me out of it. And I found myself, after this kind of angry approach to activism, I found myself in the company of people who were practicing engaged Buddhism and people involved in the Catholic worker movement and people who spoke of repairing the world from the Jewish tradition. And I was just really inspired by all of these diverse faith-based approaches to changing the world. It felt to me like they loved people more than they hated the system, which was different from the other activists that I had spent time with. The more that I kind of got involved in that kind of work, the more it occurred to me that the diversity movement that I'd been involved in college paid no attention to religion, although religion inspired all of this really profound social change work. And so the notion of what does it look like to bring people from different religions together to act on their shared value of positive social change, that's where the genesis of what was once Interfaith Youth Core, which was the name the organization was founded under, and what turned into what is now Interfaith America, that's kind of the genesis of it.
So you're an Ismaili Muslim, and I visited the Ismaili Center in Houston, which I urge anyone who's anywhere near Houston to check it out because it's really beautiful. And you detail growing up in the Midwest as an Indian Muslim and experiences of racism where they would call you Hindu, and then you'd talk to your mom about it, and she's like, we're not Hindu. And then you would say, well, like, I don't think that's where they really intend, mom. It's just, racism. And I was reminded of the way I grew up. So you and I are contemporaries. We're both in our mid to late 40s. I grew up in an upstate New York town that was predominantly, almost exclusively white. And I got called chink and ching chong and stuff like that fairly regularly. And, you know, I responded to it differently than you did. Can you describe your response?
So the racism that I experienced growing up was ugly and it hurt. And there were many times when the middle school lunchroom felt like, you know, the fifth circle of hell. And one of the ways that I responded to it was by trying to be as white as possible, which meant, you know, back when I was growing up, it meant playing basketball and listening to a certain kind of music, but also very
deliberately. Was that hip hop or what was
it? It was glam metal. It was glam metal, you know. And there are kind of
so
high quality.
What bands are we talking about? Like
well, back then it was Motley Crue and Poison and Whitesnake. And then, you know, there's quality stuff like Metallica. Whether or not it's your cup of tea, there's, you know, quality to the music.
All right, so things we had in common. I also tried to play sports in part so I could be more American. I felt self-conscious about being the scrawny Asian kid. I also got angry, which I got the sense you did as well. There was one very cutting story you told of, I believe it was your younger cousin showed up, and instead of being her protector, you kind of teased her along with other people, and she was like, "What the heck is going on?" And you were just like, "Hey, this will make me seem more of the normal American crowd if I also am piling on." And I was like, whoa, like, you know, the fact that you admitted, I mean, you know, obviously it's like we're kids and people do things. I never had a cousin show up, so I don't know what I would have done. But there were things like where you were reading it, where it was deeply relatable. And now you're a parent like I am. You have two boys. How old are your boys?
12 and 15.
Well, a bit older than mine. You got an earlier start. Mine are 10 and 7. And you write in your book about some of the ways where even now you still accommodate various things just to accomplish goals or make life easier. I remember your father talked about owning a Subway franchise, and someone was like, "Why Subway?" And it was like, well, you know, you can just seem American because when someone comes in, then you know, like they don't really think about who owns it. There was another episode you related of someone not wanting you to make their sandwich. They wanted the white sandwich maker to make the sandwich, and you put two and two together. You're like, I think it's because they prefer the white person make the sandwich.
Yeah. I mean, Andrew, you read deep into the book and you're remembering a lot of the stories, and I'm really grateful for that. And you know, one of the things I'm very blunt about in the book is just the ugliness of racism and the way that it affected me and also didn't entirely define me. And you know, I grew up in a household in which my parents were very clear. Our culture is a privilege. Our faith is a privilege. And you should look at it as such. And because I think they were immigrants, and because life in America was better than life elsewhere. And I think that it's important to kind of underscore this, that when people talk about America, the question is, what's your reference point? And if your reference point is heaven, America is light years away. But if your reference point is a country where you can't breathe the air or drink the water, then this nation looks pretty good. And that's not an argument for complacency. That's an argument for possibility. What can you build from here? How can you grow from here? So I want to be really clear-eyed about my experiences of racism, about what my kids now are going through, but also clear-eyed about it did not define me. It doesn't have to define me. And I do not only have to react to that. That my culture is not about opposing somebody else's hatred of me. My culture is about growing into who I am meant to be. You know, as I say to my kids, I don't want you to hate Islamophobia more than you love Islam.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's a beautiful sentiment and obviously spot on. I mean, the theme of we need to build really is about trying to figure out what the beautiful social order we're aspiring for is, as opposed to just trying to tear things down. And you talk about college a fair amount. You relate your own college experiences. So you go to college, you're taught a particular academic approach to racism and opposing it. And this is one of the major themes of your book, and I can sense one of the major things you're concerned about is that right now there are a lot of people who are going to college who are taught to critique. And you yourself were a product of that. But then someone, after you were critiquing an interfaith gathering and you said, look, this should be much more young and representative and dynamic and involve the next generation, then someone put their hand on your shoulder and said, you should build that. And then you said, okay, I will build that.
That was almost 25 years ago. It was June of 1998. Yeah, that's really the kind of, you know, that's the creation myth of Interfaith America, my organization. And it just happens to be true, unlike, say, the Plymouth Rock myth, you know. It happens to be true that I was a light things on fire activist. And I did this at this interfaith gathering. And of course, I'd gone to this gathering because I wanted to drink from the well of positive, faith-inspired, love people first social change. But I had been so deeply kind of steeped in this approach of raise your fist and tell other people what they're doing wrong, that when, you know, it was one boring panel of senior theologians after another, I stood up, raised my fist, and I was like, you people are boring. Where's the young people? Where's the edge? Where's the energy? Where's the dynamism? And that's when this woman, Yolan Trevino, approached me and was like, hey, you know, it's powerful what you're putting out there. You should build that. And actually, my first thought, Andrew, was somebody's calling my bluff.
You know? Oh, no.
And I actually think that there's a lot of critique out there that is deathly afraid of somebody calling their bluff. And that is not my critique of critique. It is my way of explaining self-righteousness, my own and other people's, that the more self-righteous somebody is in calling out things that are terrible, there's a possibility that there's a deep fear about being asked to take responsibility and to be the one in charge. But, you know, we need to not just tell people what's wrong with the police. We need to have people who can be in charge of public safety. Like, public safety is a really important thing. And telling people what's wrong with one segment of the public safety ecosystem without the corresponding ability to build up that ecosystem into something that works, into something that protects people, that's the challenge we need to solve, right? This doesn't mean the critique isn't valid. It just means it's incomplete. And you know, I have a friend who is a professor at an elite East Coast school in the Boston area. It's not Harvard. It's another one. And he said, you know, my big fear is that we're teaching our students who pay $75,000 a year in tuition, room, and board, we teach them to critique the things that kids go to regional public universities to do. People go to Framingham State to learn how to become teachers, social workers, and nurses, and people come to our school to learn how to critique those folks. And that just seems unfair. It just seems unfair.
This podcast is sponsored by Helix Sleep. I have always been a mattress guy. I thought if you're going to spend 8 hours doing something, you should pay attention to what you're doing it on. That's why I love the Helix Sleep product. It is made for me. I am someone who sleeps on my back. I do not sleep hot. I like a firm mattress. And so when I took the Helix Sleep quiz, I wound up with a Helix Dawn model. And it's been fantastic, not just for me, but for my kids who seek it out of the entire house. Don't want to take my word for it? Helix has been awarded the number one mattress pick by GQ and Wired magazine, and they have a 100-night free trial and 10 to 15-year warranties baked in. That's confidence in your product. And if you get on a Helix Sleep mattress, you will see why they are so confident. Helix is offering 20% off all mattress orders and 2 free pillows for our listeners. Go to helixsleep.com/yang and use code HELIXPARTNER20. This is their best offer yet, and it won't last long. With Helix, better sleep starts now. So how old were you when Yolanda said to you, hey, you should start this yourself?
Yeah, her name is Yolande, and Yolande Trevino. And actually, we just had our 20th anniversary celebration of Interfaith America and brought her here from LA and had a chance to thank her in person. It was really beautiful. It was June of 1998. I was 22.
Yeah, so 22. So a 22-year-old trying to build something, I know this from experience because I tried it or tried a version of it a couple of years later. Excruciatingly hard.
Yeah.
So what the heck was the first thing you did as a 22-year-old when you said, okay, I guess I will do this thing?
So what I did was I ran, or I was involved in the group of people running the youth programs of these adult interfaith organizations I had critiqued. So I want to point out not so much the irony of that, because I was the guy raising my fist telling them that they were terrible and boring and backwards. I want to point out the generosity of those folks, right? So they could have told me to go take a hike, right? I was not particularly polite in my critique. Instead, they were like, hey, why don't you come and make this better? Why don't you attach your caboose to our locomotive? And I learned how to do interfaith work by helping to run the youth program at the United Religions Initiative and at the Parliament of the World's Religions, et cetera, et cetera. And I had a fancy scholarship. I was at Oxford on the money left by some old British colonialist, and I used that money to go around the world and learn the methodology of interfaith work. And then when I finally finished my PhD, it was just a few months after September 11th, I realized that this – the world kind of needed an organization that focused on bringing young people inspired by diverse faiths together in service and social action projects that was all about interfaith bridge building. And actually, the world was ready for it, right? So Tony Blair paid attention and Bill Clinton paid attention. And we, you know, did a project with Queen Rania of Jordan and all kinds of inspiring things.
Well, so you really met the moment, because after 9/11, there must have been an incredible swell of interest in helping people understand different faiths, particularly Islam at that time.
Yeah, and you know, for a long time, I played the friendly Muslim on TV. You know, I would joke that I was the Muslim that didn't scare white people. I was the Muslim Mr. Rogers. And the truth, Andrew, is that's actually who I am by personality. I wasn't just playing a character on TV. Like I'm genuinely kind of a mild-mannered person. I'm genuinely a person who believes that Islam's core value is mercy, and that applying that mercy in the world through kindness and through love and hospitality and compassion is the way to go. And I'm also totally tenacious about organization building. And a huge part of my book, We Need to Build, is about the tenacity of building an organization and the strategy involved. And so, you know, I would do things like, even if there's kind of ambient interest in a different side of Islam or an interfaith work, you still have to go after it, right? And so nobody's going to hand you anything. I remember telling people about Interfaith Youth Corps back when it was named that, and them saying things like, we're never going to fund you. You know, it's interesting. I'll give you advice, but we're going to fund you. I would find out the conferences those people were going to be at, and I would show up at those conferences and sit next to them, right? Not to bug them, right? But to communicate my seriousness, my tenacity. And that was an era, you'll remember this, where Ashoka and social entrepreneurship was celebrated. David Bornstein had just written the book, How to Change the World. Wendy Kopp and Teach for America were widely celebrated. Muhammad Yunus and the Grameen Bank. It was kind of the era of building things, right? Social change was creating a better way to do something, and then building an institution to that. And I would say that I was very much formed in that era. Like my initial formation as an activist was through angry activism in the early 90s. And then it was through faith-based activism with, you know, the Dalai Lama and Thich Nhat Hanh and Mother Teresa and Dorothy Day and the like. And then it was social entrepreneurship and building an institution to a better way of doing things. And that's really what I write about in the book, is what does it mean to not tell people what they're doing wrong? You know, the goal of social change is not a more ferocious revolution. It is a better social order. It's a better way of doing things, whether that's healthcare or education or arts or racial equity. what does it mean to create a better way of doing things and then to build an institution that can advance that pattern change, that is a really hard thing to do. And self-righteousness will not get you very far in that endeavor, right? What will get you far is long-term strategy and day-to-day chopping wood and carrying water.
Yeah, you tell stories about the early years of what became Interfaith America, and you're very blunt about it. Someone advised you saying, look, you can't be afraid of money, but you can't be crazy for it either. And yet you did what most organizations do, and as someone who's run a nonprofit, I could relate very directly to this, is that someone would come and write you a grant to do certain work, and you'd be like, sure. You know, it's sort of related, like, let's go do it. It was only later when you got certain partners that you started to say no to more things, strip away some projects that weren't core to the vision that you then ended up formulating. How many years did it take for you to get from being responsive to having this firmer vision?
Yeah, it's a great question. 7-8 years. So the first 3 or 4 years of Interfaith Youth Corps was really building a methodology that was 1998 to 2002. We get our first grant in 2002. It's about 7 years of running entrepreneurial projects, some super exciting things like a youth exchange with Queen Rania of Jordan and a Faith Sect fellowship with Tony Blair, but you know, some totally random things like the foundation for General Motors gives us a grant to do, I don't know, grassroots work in 4 or 5 cities. That's kind of totally random, but it's a grant, so we do it. The State Department is literally constantly calling us, like on a monthly basis, to do interfaith youth projects around the world. And so we're in Central Asia, and we're in Eastern Europe, and we're in the Middle East, and we're like all over the place, right? And we don't really have expertise in this. We're just super entrepreneurial. And it's not until 2009, 2010, at which point 3 things happen. One is a consulting firm does a pro bono strategic plan for us and just basically says, hey, listen, you're not making a long-term difference anywhere. You need to have a long-term strategic goal. You need to have a plan to reach it. It's not especially genius, but it is very clarifying. So that's one thing that happens. The second thing that happens is I get an appointment on President Obama's inaugural Faith Council. So there's kind of a national profile and a level of seriousness that comes along with that appointment, not to mention like a whole new set of contacts. And, you know, you're like literally in the Oval Office in the Roosevelt Room every once in a while. And then finally, there's a really serious philanthropist named David Einhorn who requests a business plan from us, which of course we're able to do because of the strategic plan that this consulting firm has done for us pro bono, and gives us $10 million. And a lot of that is tenacity and a lot of it is luck, the ability to have a serious amount of money to be able to then articulate a 5-year vision and to build a team to go after that vision.
This podcast is sponsored by ExpressVPN. Going online without ExpressVPN is like changing while leaving your window wide open. You might not have anything to hide, but why give randos a chance to invade your privacy? When you go online without a VPN, ISPs can see every single website you visit, and they can legally sell this information without your consent to ad companies and big tech, who can then use your data to target you and profit, not to your benefit, generally at your expense. So using ExpressVPN, it's like being a member of a high-tech company that's on your side, where they beam you into a server in another part of the world. No one can see anything you do. Just fire up the app, click one button, and you're beamed onto a completely safe, anonymized internet. They can't do anything with your data. I use ExpressVPN to have that peace of mind. To secure your online activity by visiting expressvpn.com/yang today. That's expressvpn.com/yang. And you can get an extra 3 months for free. expressvpn.com/yang. Oh, so here's where I want to dig in a little bit, because it'll be fun and interesting. So first, let me say I admire you and your work a great deal, and you've helped a lot of people in this country. And I 1,000% agree with your critique of the prevalence of critique as like the mode of expression for young people in academic context in particular, where they're just like, hey, you guys are screwing this up in this way and that way. And then the flip side has to be like, okay, like let's actually build something. Let's solve the problem. Let's do something solutions oriented. And you became this social entrepreneur, and you're one of the most successful social entrepreneurs in the country. But there are all of these young people that actually want to follow this general path in terms of social entrepreneurship. If you say social entrepreneurship on a college campus, like all these folks will be like, ooh, yeah, like that's the dream. That's the ideal. But of a group of people who set out to be a social entrepreneur the way that you did, it's such a rough road because like the marketplace for it is wildly divergent, not terribly well resourced. The message of the book, which like I love, is like, look, we need to build things. Another message of the book is like, it's super hard to build, which I totally agree with because I've done it a couple of times and it's super hard. There is a bit of a gauntlet you're throwing down to say to folks like, look, guys, we need to actually try and create better institutions and not just be the bomb throwers or the, you know, like the critics. But there's some part of me that's like, man, like, you've already been through like this journey. And in your case, you've been through a journey that's longer and more, elevated than just about any of us. You must have seen a whole host of people embark on a similar path to yourself, at different points in time. But then their journey was very, very different than yours.
So I think building a new institution that is helping to create or revitalize a sector is enormously challenging, and one has to have a significant amount of luck. What I've done is challenging, and I've had a significant amount of luck. Alhamdulillah, praise be to God. Yeah. And what I would say is it is not a gargantuan mountain to climb to improve the civic activity or area of work that you're currently involved in. If you are the director of a summer camp at a YMCA, you can think of better ways to run that summer camp, right? If that summer camp includes a wider diversity of people, and as you see how the camp might work for some and not others, there are important changes that you can implement that make that a better summer camp. And because you work within an ecosystem called the YMCA or the public schools or the Jewish community centers or whatever it might be, the ways that you improve the environment in which you are working, the hospital floor, the after-school program, whatever it might be, has a chance of spreading. So what I've done is a little bit different, right? What Muhammad Yunus did with the Grameen Bank, what Wendy Kopp did with Teach for America, what you, Andrew, did with Venture, this is a little bit different, right? They are new institutions that don't exist within a vast and well-developed ecosystem that effectively have to build both an institution and an ecosystem. But a lot of what I talk about in We Need to Build is the genius of American civil society, Catholic Charities and Habitat for Humanity and the world of Methodist college campuses, et cetera, et cetera. And there is a reasonable chance that if you're involved in social change work, you are working in one of those areas. Improve the thing below your feet. Improve the after-school program. Improve the summer camp. Improve the way of doing teacher training. Improve the way of doing nursing. And ask yourself the question, can my civic innovation in the classroom, on the hospital floor, can this spread? Right? And so it's what I call a Jane Jacobs approach to social change rather than a Robert Moses approach. Right now, there's an awful lot of talk about systemic change. I mean, on the one hand, this is not an argument for our systems being perfect. It's a recognition that, like, if you're having a hard time running a 6-person English department at your local college campus, maybe you should be a little bit like less self-righteous about proposing vast changes for 100 million person systems, right? Why not take the approach that Jane Jacobs took to social change, which is ask the question, what's going right locally? What are the environments in which kids play together, in which moms talk to each other, et cetera, et cetera? How can we create more environments like that? As opposed to the Robert Moses approach, which is I'm going to create this perfect system in my boardroom with a group of experts, and then we're going to come out and impose it upon everybody. And who cares if Fifth Avenue is going to run through Washington Square Park?
Well, you know, you talked about this colleague of yours in college where you were both on a board together, and he was determined to get a bench outside of the dorm. And he was like, because then people will have some place to sit and they hang out. And then you looked at that and were like, come on, that's not like what we should be about. But it sounds like what you just described is that older, wiser, you would be like, yeah, that bench is a good idea.
I mean, this guy's name was Doug. And Andrew, I mean, you not only did you read the book, but you like actually paid attention to page after page. I'm really appreciative of that. I'm really honored by that because, look, I just have huge admiration for what you've done. As I told you, like, you built an institution and then you brought that ethos to the national stage. And so I just stand in admiration of you. And like, it makes my month, and this is my birthday month, it makes my month that you paid such attention to my book. So thank you for that. So you know, the story that you're relating from my book is University of Illinois has Chief Illini Wick as a mascot, and it's a racist mascot. And as I kind of, you know, realized that, I made it my literally crusade to like hound everybody within eyesight and earshot about the need to change this mascot. And I was, you know, very enamored of the idea that every minority had a particular stake in this because, you know, this is specifically racist against Native Americans, but anybody who had any kind of skin tone should be able to relate to racial oppression. And so I would hound this guy Doug about why he, you know, seemed kind of neutral to positive on Chief Illini Wick. And he at one, you know, I would tell him like, you know, if basically some version of real black people are opposed to Chief Illini Wick. And he was a super mild-mannered guy, but at one point he just lost it. I mean, he's like, stop telling me what real black people do.
Wow.
Stop telling. And if you think about it, like that's an awful lot of identity-based activism is articulating a standard of authenticity and telling people that they're not living up to it, right? As opposed to saying, being black or Asian or Latino is a range not just of cultures and nationalities, but it's also a range of personality types and sexual orientations and religions. And I'm really curious about the ways that manifests in the world. I'm going to let the amazing mosaic of black people define for me what black is, right? As opposed to having kind of this standard of authenticity based on an imagined ideology and superimpose that on people. In any case, that's what I did. And when he like lost it on me, I think that was, you know, probably the last time I went around telling people what their authentic self should be. And I take that, it was a gift that he gave me, even though in the moment it burned. And Doug's approach to social change was watch what people are doing and watch where things are healthy and positive and help that be the case. And he was like, you know, outside Allen Hall, where we were president and vice president of the dormitory, people like to hang out and they have to sit on this cold cement and we should have benches where they can sit. And it was a Jane Jacobs approach to social change. Pay attention to people in their natural habitats and what makes them happy and help them achieve that. And sometimes the solution is simple, and it's actually better if it's simple. It's actually better if it's simple, right? If you can improve people's lives in ways that don't require major surgery, you should do that. I appreciate his example.
Knowing how to speak and understand a new language can be an invaluable tool when traveling, meeting new friends, or just even to master a new skill. But it's not always simple when you're bogged down by textbooks and structure classes. That's why so many people trust Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. It truly immerses you in the language you want to learn, like Spanish, French, Italian, Chinese, and more. You won't just be studying English translations. The Rosetta Stone intuitive process helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/rs10. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/rs10 today.
You told one story that, again, some of your stories, man, I was like, wow, grateful that you were sharing it. You told a story, by the way, I can relate to so much of this. So you're having a terrible travel day, and it seems like you're going to miss a shuttle that is going to make you late to get back to your family. Your wife's going to be furious. And everyone on this bus is like a white dude in khakis, and there's a bus driver that has sat them all. And you're afraid you're going to miss this shuttle. And so you say something to the bus driver about how, like, I can't believe that you have kicked, like, the only non-white dude, like, off of this shuttle bus. And then she becomes very afraid.
And not only that, like, she didn't kick me off the bus. She just didn't invite me on the bus first. And I wound up being, like, last in line. And the reason for that was because I was looking at my phone. Right. And now I had signed up earlier to take the shuttle. And so I figured that like there was some list and I'd be called off the list. So, you know, I wasn't entirely in the wrong, but you could easily have like if I was even had an iota of generosity towards this bus driver, she's running late. It's like 6 a.m. in LA. You know, she's harried and she's like getting a group of people on the bus as quickly as possible. And I'm the distracted guy looking at my phone and she's not leaving me off the bus. She's just like, you know, it's your job to get on the bus. Right. And I was thinking to myself, well, my name's on some list somewhere. And that's when I say, you know, oh yeah, of course, leave the brown guy off the bus. And this look of sheer terror crosses her face, like sheer terror. And she goes inside and I see her having this like intense conversation with the desk clerk. And what she's basically doing is she's like preempting whatever I might my possible complaint. Like she is having the desk clerk document that, you know, she didn't do anything racist or wrong, that, you know, just in case I accuse her of something. And I thought to myself, I could accuse her of something. And in the era in which we live, my accusation would be taken probably without that much investigation. And this is a $12 or $15 an hour, you know, shuttle bus driver. And I am, you know, a reasonably high powered knowledge worker. And as I write in the book, I probably went to school with some of the people up the chain in the bus company, whatever, right? And it's, I have power. And telling somebody else that they have committed a racist act or an act that is racialized is an accusation with power. And when it is said with somebody with power, it can lead to bad things. And I knew that abstractly, and I'd certainly read a number of stories along those lines, which made me uncomfortable. Like I was like, this is a terrible thing that's happening to this museum curator or you know, whatever, this janitor at Smith College, famous story that happened that was in the New York Times. But now I was the person who was in an indirect way kind of accusing somebody of doing something bad to me on account of my race, and that person was terrified. And I'm like, I don't want to be this guy, and I don't think that every misunderstanding should be immediately racialized if there is no evidence of that, and that somebody should be scared to death of losing their hourly wage as a result of it. Now, as I write in the book, and Andrew, as you said earlier, there's also incidents where I've been working at my parents' subways in which something happens that is clearly racist, not just racialized, and which I have had to, you know, swallow my dignity, right? And so both of these things occur in our world. Both of these things occur in our world. But here's what I'm clear about. My experience of racism as a worker in my parents' subways as a kid is not neutralized or made better by my accusation of somebody, of a shuttle bus driver doing something racist towards me if the act that they are committing is not in fact racist.
Again, the fact that you were able to own the substance of that situation, even as you're relating your behavior, I thought was really compelling. And you observe that in terms of the relative privilege or power in American life, a lot of it is around education, and that's going to be something, unfortunately, that's fueling our political polarization in a particular way. And that one of your concerns is that there are people who emphasize different forms of marginalization, even while they have like a ton of educational privilege. And then you're looking around saying like, hey, like, are you really oppressed or unprivileged relative to the bus driver or the person who is working at the janitorial staff and at the university?
Yeah, I mean, Andrew, this was the centerpiece of your campaign, and I think it says a lot about you that you are focusing entirely on me in this podcast, even though so much of who you are about as a presidential candidate and a mayoral candidate and what the Forward Party is about is that our economy has fundamentally shifted, and it leaves vast swaths of people out. And we don't have an answer to that going into the future, right? And so I write a little bit about this, but it should just be said, you're the national leader in this area, and we should all appreciate what you have done in bringing this conversation to the fore, and I am certainly one of those. So listen, there's an awful lot of talk, and I think it is legit and real about the power associated with being male, with being white, with being quote-unquote able-bodied. What about the power associated with being book smart? If you're book smart in a knowledge economy, boy, that is an unbelievable amount of power, right? There are just things I can't do. Like I can't play a guitar as much as I've tried. I can't really shoot baskets. I'm not very good at basketball as much as I tried. Can't fix a car, but I can put together a speech. I have an innate sense of strategy for an organization. I can read a room, right? I'm a knowledge worker. And in the vast majorities of human societies, in the vast majority of eras, my set of skills would be not especially important. Not, you know, I can't shoot an arrow. I can't ride a horse. I'm not a warrior, right? But in this particular time and place, the small set of things that I'm good at is king. It's highly rewarded. It is highly desirable. And I just don't understand why we don't think of it as a massive privilege to have book smarts in a knowledge economy. Forget access to education. All of us know people who had access to amazing educations who just weren't book smart, right? And so let's be honest about that. And I think one of the things about our current discourse is it doesn't engage in that at all. Like I'll never forget. I want to relate to two quick stories. I actually forget whether these are in the book or not.
I'll tell you. Hey, go ahead.
Yeah. That's amazing. So I was at, it's a small college in Ohio. It was either Oberlin or Kenyon, actually. I don't remember exactly which one. And I'm meeting with the multicultural student group, right? The students of color. And let me say, I get it. Like being a Latino kid or an African American kid in like rural Ohio at a largely white campus, like I get that there's a certain amount of alienation that comes with that, especially if you are from a family background or an economic background that is different from the ones that most of your classmates. But I'm sitting with these students, and there's a lot of talk of oppression and et cetera, it's marginalization. And I'm listening, and I turn around and I look for a second at the white woman who has set up the tea and coffee and cookies. And she is like looking at these students with her mouth agape, and half of her teeth are missing. And I'm like, what is going on in rural Ohio in 2015? It's like meth and opioids. And it would just, I just think it would have been nice for the students at Oberlin or Kenyon to just maybe moderate their talk about being oppressed around the woman who was making $13 an hour, missing half her teeth, setting up their cookies, you know, and note, I am not accusing anybody of anything.
No, yeah.
I'm saying, let's pay attention to the world, right? Like I remember I tell the story towards the end of my book. My first year at Oxford was really hard. I mean, it was really emotionally hard, right? It was really emotionally hard. And at the end of that year, I took a trip with my dad to India, and I've got this whole, like, you know, ideological story of, like, how Oxford doesn't like that the empire has struck back, and there's all these Asian students at Oxford, and, like, Oxford is making it deliberately hard for them, and it's this colonial mentality, and, you know, we the oppressed are rising up. And my dad looks at me, and he points to this leprous beggar child on the street, points to one of them. There must be dozens of them on the street in front of us. Points to the one and said, if you're oppressed, what word do you have for him? Yeah.
Yeah.
Like if there are not enough mental gymnastics in the world for me and a leprous beggar child to belong in the same category and for that category to be called oppressed. Okay, so if that's the case, right, if there are actually like billions of people in the world who live on less than $6 a day, true. Okay, and if I can't get through breakfast without spending $6, you know.
Yeah, that's true for me.
Maybe I should just think of myself as something other than oppressed. Well, what would it look like to think of myself as privileged and to embrace that privilege? And to then ask the question, what's the responsibility that ensues from that? And actually, how wonderful is it to think of oneself as privileged, right? That and this is partially a religious thing, like God has blessed you, which by the way is like the basic message of the Quran. God has blessed you. Now it is your job to be a mercy to other people. That is actually massively liberating. And it's massively inspiring. Like, why not walk around the world thinking to yourself, I am amongst the most privileged people in human history, which for most of us is objectively true. Okay, now what can I give to others?
That's a very different message than a lot of people are getting, for sure. And a message that I think is empowering.
Yeah. Right. You know, my son, my older son was in a diversity program, like this intensive summer diversity program last summer. And he comes home one day and he's like, Dad, how come only the white Christian kids get to call themselves privileged? I'll repeat that, right? How come only the white Christian kids get to call themselves privileged? And it just seems crazy that we don't consider people's cultural identities a privilege. I mean, how much time do I spend in my home telling my kids that their faith is Islam, that their heritage from India, that their citizenship in America is a privilege and they're supposed to make the most of it, that their family lineage is a privilege and they're supposed to make the most of it, not in a way that's meant to be kind of the anxiety of influence, right? But in a way that's meant to be empowering. You have the wind at your back. What will you do with it, right? It just seems, you know, again, it's objectively true that we're amongst the most privileged people in human history. It's also beautifully inspiring for us to embrace that.
Picture that super soft t-shirt you love sleeping in, the one that gets softer and softer the more you wear it. Now you can bring that same lived-in softness to your entire bed with Signature Vintage Wash Sheets from Boll & Branch. This all-new collection is even softer than your favorite t-shirt, with a distinctly relaxed look and feel for your best night's sleep. Just like all Boll & Branch bedding, Signature Vintage Wash Sheets start with the highest quality, 100% organic cotton. The lived-in feel comes from a small batch washing process, creating a level of softness you've never felt before. And it's not just the feel. Boll & Branch mastered the laid-back aesthetic using a special technique that creates the well-loved look you'll find with vintage jeans. And true to the Boll & Branch hallmark, signature vintage wash sheets get softer and softer with every wash. Right now, you can get 15% off your first order with promo code ODYSSEY and save on their most relaxing sheets. So head to BollAndBranch.com today. That's B-O-L-L and Branch.com.
Yeah, it gives us more control of our own destiny and more of an eye for the impact we can have on the world. It's certainly a much better way to approach your interactions with others than to what you said in the book. And there are a lot of quotes I love in the book, but you talked about how something can be a useful lens, but you don't want to have it permanently change your eyesight so that you only see like the wrongs of the world or like the weaknesses of institutions.
Right. Yeah. I think an awful lot of anti-racism, et cetera, it's a really interesting and useful critique. I don't know if it's a great paradigm, and I definitely don't think it's a good regime. By regime, I mean like something that gets implemented into the world, right? But it's really interesting to constantly be thinking, are there ways that racism is affecting this situation? Should we be attuned to that? I think the question that is absolutely the case. We should always be attuned to the possibility of that. We should watch out for it. We should gather evidence around it. It could be the case that a shuttle bus driver leaves me out because I'm brown. It's not crazy for me to consider that a possibility, but it is totally unfair for me to accuse somebody of that without evidence, especially when that accusation is power, right? And so that's an interesting critique, a paradigm, and a regime. And, you know, we talk a lot at Interfaith America about the metaphor of potluck nation, that we can't have a diversity paradigm that's a battleground, right, where there's only the wicked and the wounded. And if you're, quote unquote, dominant culture, you're the wicked. And you have to confess your privilege. And then you go through this strange alchemy and you're now an ally. But if you're the wounded, then the only opportunity you have, the only script, is to constantly recount your pain and your wounds.
Yeah.
But that's a form of entrapment, right?
Yeah.
It's a form of entrapment. What we should be thinking about is we're a potluck and you're welcoming the distinctive and delicious contributions of diverse people and nurturing creative combinations amongst them. That's the metaphor.
You talk in the book about how there are some bright black high school students who get pushed by well-intended teachers and mentors to write essays about how painful their past is and how difficult things were. You describe it as like the single story, which is like, oh, there's a single story that defines groups of people. And so if you're from this group, then you should go along with what these institutions want. And some of these students were like, what if that's not me? Or what if that's not my reality? Or like, what if I would rather just talk about something else about myself rather than some painful experiences I've overcome?
Right. The single story was a TED talk by Adichie, I think is the name of the writer and speaker. This notion of we're in a particular paradigm of diversity work, people are handed an invisible script where some people have to constantly confess their guilt and other people have to constantly recount their pain. That just doesn't make sense to me, right? My kids are telling me all the time that they have a set of like well-meaning adults in their lives who constantly want to hear about how terrible their experience with Islamophobia is. So my kids have been called some ugly names in the playground. That is real. I'm glad that there are adults who are attuned to that. But what they get from Islam is infinitely more important than how they have been hurt by Islamophobia. And there doesn't seem to be that many well-meaning adults in the current era interested in that. And that's a problem. That's a problem.
Yes. That's really profound I personally, like I try and see how my kids are growing up. They don't seem that attuned to racism. I'm not sure how much has happened to them as yet. But to the extent that I had a lot of teasing or even bullying when I was growing up. And I responded to it in various ways, and I became, you know, an angry Asian guy who went to the gym a little bit too much. but putting yourself in one of these buckets, and you actually don't use this language in the book, but I love it. It's like the wicked versus the wounded. You know, like most of us are much more than that set of experiences. And really, one of the things I just realized that you did in your book is that you actually put yourself in the shoes of the wicked occasionally, even though, you know, in your case, you know, that was often, you know, very, very much contextual.
Yeah. Yeah. Racism is deforming. I have a close friend who developed a really ugly gambling habit and finally, you know, went to inpatient treatment, a lot of therapy. And when I talked about like what he discovered, when we talked about what he discovered about himself in the course of this intensive therapy, he was like, a lot of my gambling problem was a response to the racism I experienced as a kid. That wow. is real. That is really, yeah. that is ugly, and it is real. And we should be clear-eyed about that. And we should be clear-eyed about other things also, right? That people are not only a response to the racism that they experienced, they are also people who are positively living out the identities that they are proud of. We should give people an opportunity to articulate that. If we go to the potluck, metaphor, we should be welcoming people's contributions, and we should be aware of the barriers to those contributions. Racism, anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, misogyny, these are barriers to people's contributions. They are a violation of the dignity of those people, and they're also things that make the potluck less delicious because they mean fewer contributions. That's dumb. It's yes. dumb and it's bad, right? We should be aware of those things, but what we should not do is tell people we're having a potluck and then tell them all the reasons that we know that they can't bring a contribution because they're too oppressed. That's crazy.
That's crazy.
It is demeaning to believe that it is demeaning to assume about other people that external forces have so oppressed them that they are unable to live in the world as it is. They're unable to.
Everyone can bring something to the potluck. That's a very everyone should bring something to the potluck. Yeah. That's like a pretty strong principle. So you worked in the Obama administration on the inaugural Faith Council. You were excited about the possibilities. Trump becomes president in 2016. We're going through rough times. You've written this book, and this book, I highly recommend it. And I think it's a really important message and a well-received message. We need to build field notes for a diverse democracy. How high is your concern level? So I'm going to let you close this on like a like what are you working on now? What are you excited about? How concerned are you? Because even if I rewind to the Obama years, there was like this sense of kind of optimism that I think has gone very sharply in the other direction over the last number of years. I mean, certainly Trump's victory got me into politics, much to my wife's chagrin. So what are you working on? Like, what are you excited about? And how concerned are you that we're going to end up falling short of our ideals?
So we're going to end up falling short of our ideals because that's what ideals are, right? And this is one of the reasons I love religion as a model of social change, because religion is about articulating the cosmic ideal, right? The intersection of deen and dunya, of faith and life, of the kingdom of God, and then building institutions that help approximate that ideal and move the world closer to it. So I'm not afraid of us falling short of our ideals. I know that we will. I think I'm afraid of us stopping to try. You know,
wow.
And I love Bill Clinton's line. I'll quote two of those lines. One is, it's okay if I fail. I'm happy to be caught trying. I love that line, right? I'm happy to be caught trying. And the second was, there's nothing that's wrong with America that what's right with America can't fix. And I believe that too, right? That somebody out there is solving the problem on a local level of racial equity in a healthcare situation. Somebody out there is solving the problem of sexism in the corporate world, et cetera, et cetera. And we need to identify those solutions and those leaders and help elevate them and scale them. But I want to answer your question directly, Andrew. What are we working on here at Interfaith America? So this book, we need to build my podcast, Interfaith America with Eboo Patel. We want to help shift the social change conversation from critics to builders. We want to shift the metaphor of diversity work in America from melting pot and battleground to potluck. We want to help facilitate in the next great chapter of American religion. We think we're done with the chapter Judeo-Christian. It did good work in its time. It's time to move into interfaith America. And we want to convince people that you defeat the things you do not love by building the things you do, and that that is a profound opportunity to be able to build something better. It is holy, it is sacred, and we should take that opportunity and be grateful for it.
Builders instead of critics, potluck instead of melting pot, and these institutions as something that we should be reinforcing, improving, celebrating, and maybe occasionally building a new one or two. I thoroughly, thoroughly endorse. If people want to follow you, it sounds like you have your own podcast, Interfaith America, and you're on social media.
Yep, Interfaith America with Eboo Patel, and I'm on Twitter at Eboo Patel. But let's see what happens with Twitter now that it's in different hands. In any case, I'm on it for now.
A lot of people are thinking the same thing, my friend. Well, congratulations on We Need to Build. We do indeed. It's a great achievement, but it pales in comparison to the achievement of your work. As someone who's been in similar types of roles, starting nonprofit organizations, the fact that you've done what you've done over like a multi-decade period, it takes a singular amount of fortitude, character, perseverance, certainly beyond me. So congratulations on everything you do.
Alhamdulillah, really, praise be to God. And don't say beyond you, because you not only built a nonprofit organization, but then you ran for president and brought the message of venture into the national conversation. So I appreciate you, and I look forward to the Forward Party, Andrew, and what's to come from you. And I look forward to the next steps in our friendship and work together genuinely.
Let's do it, man. Let's build it, Eboo. Appreciate Indeed. The heck out of you.
Thank you.